Thanks. Don't mute yourself because you are up, sir. Let us welcome Peter.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, Peter, I am an alcoholic. And I did not get sober because I was sitting in a cell. I did not get sober because my wife was packing my bags. I did not get sober because my employer handed me a pink slip. I did not get sober because of so many external things that lead us in this direction. I got sober because of something that is written on page 21 of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And on that page, it talks about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I was always a jolly drunk until I was widowed. And when my wife passed away and I got a kid with cerebral palsy, alcohol did not fix me. It didn't change. And in fact, I was no longer that funny drunk. I was enraged. It increased my anger. And that's why I got sober. I got sober because I was scared. I was scared of me when I got drunk. The resistance I have when I'm sober to my behaviors that are inappropriate ebbed away when I drank. And I was never a fighter. My whole life, I was not a fighter. But when I, after I was widowed, that edge, you know, that that resistance. And I didn't get in fights after she died and before I got sober. I just had that rage about me. And anger is a funny thing because of, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross talks about the steps of, you know, grief, of recovery from grief. And the last one is anger. And I could never get to that point because I always felt like I had to be angry at someone, either my dead wife or my child with cerebral. I had to be angry at something. And the reality is about 10 years ago, I finally figured out that I could walk around and be angry. And like, oh, that's what's going on. I'm getting to the point of acceptance with finally, you know, that I can just be angry. And I don't have to be angry at someone or something or some, you know, occurrence, that it's okay for me to be angry, you know, and I can, you know, call up someone and say, I'm just angry. I'm not going to do anything about it, but I'm just angry. And it's like, okay. So my journey, when you guys asked me to talk last week, it was like, oh, I don't know if I want to do this, you know, because I've done it before. Sometimes I want to go out and get drunk so I have a new story. but here we go. I was born in a little town. It was little when I was born. El Cajon, east of San Diego, about 26 miles, during the Truman administration, which was a long time ago. I don't know if my father was an alcoholic or not. My father had a full paid scholarship to the University of Michigan in 1939 in art. So what does that tell you about his personality? Intuitive, sensitive, creative, all those things. And he was. He used to do chalk drawings, and he was innovative when it came to artsy kind of things. You take that personality and drop it into the Battle of the Bulge during World War II. And I once asked him, I said, what was the most common memory you had from World War II? And he said, blood mixing in with mud. That was the most common memory that he remembered. And then I saw that movie, Saving Private Ryan, and it's all through that movie. And it's like, I see that, you know. And my father refused to go camping with me when I was a kid. He said, I camped all the way across Europe in the rain and the mud. I'm not going camping, you know. And I'm sorry that he couldn't do that, because it's one more thing that kept us apart. His drinking kept me away from him. Because when he was sober, he was this sensitive, open, caring kind of guy that, you know, really looked out for me. But then when he was drunk, he was this angry, mean, violent guy. And so as a sensitive upcoming alcoholic, I had to make a choice between being close to my dad and not being close to my dad. And I chose not to be close. Like whichever way you're going, I'm going in the opposite direction, you know? And so I graduated from one alcoholic family into another when I joined the United States Navy. And I had planned on joining the Navy years before because I wanted to get out of my alcoholic home. I mean, I grew up with an alcoholic father, a very codependent German Catholic woman, and a sister who has ADHD really bad. And so I always felt like I didn't belong there. We hear that in AA all the time. I didn't feel like I belonged here. I was waiting for the mothership to come home to get me. I just didn't fit. Well, the thing is, my father killed himself a month before I graduated from high school. And if I had someone in my life who I trusted, you know, could have walked up to me and said, you know, you don't have to join the Navy. You don't have to you made these plans, you know, 4 years ago. And that's one of my character defects is I make plans and I stick to them. Well, some people could say, well, that's not a defect. That's an asset. Well, you know, take time to think about it, you know, roll it over in your mind. You know, I mean, my dad died and I was going to leave my family because of my father. Well, my father was no longer in the family, so I really didn't have to leave. Of course, the draft was on my ass. And so it was the best thing to do. And and that's where I really learned to drink. And that's where I really learned to be a periodic, because I'd spend 4 to 6 weeks at sea and then, you know, pull into the Philippines or Japan or Hong Kong or someplace like that. And you're in port for 6 days. Well, I'm getting drunk for 6 days, you know? And so I could stop it when I wanted to. And see, and that's one thing too, is when I started looking at, am I really, 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 really an alcoholic? You know, because I can stop and start, you know? Because I hear so many stories about, oh, you know, you pick up the first drink and you're screwed and all that, you know? And I'm going, God, that's not my problem. My problem is my who I am when I'm drinking. You know, we go back to page 21 again, that Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I don't like who I am when I drink. That's why I quit drinking, you know? And so went through the Navy. As usual, I'm sitting in a board ship and there is a copy of Modern Photography just laying around the spaces. So I'm flipping through it. And I find on this page down in the bottom right-hand corner, there's this little ad. It says, you can be a photographer. And so I'm reading the ad, and it's from Brooks Institute of Photography in Santa Barbara, California. And I think, you know, do I ask anybody, you know, this is one of my major character defects, is I don't ask questions. You know, I just make a decision. I'm just going to do this. You know, normal people go and talk to professional photographers and say, tell me the good points about being a photographer. Tell me the bad points about being a photographer. You know, I didn't do that. I just, you know, sent off a letter saying, yeah. And once they figured out I had the GI Bill, they said, yeah. So I moved to Santa Barbara. In 71, right after I got out of the Navy, and I went to Brooks for 2 semesters and didn't like it. And because there was no excitement, I had just got done working on a flight deck for 4 years. And I'll tell you one thing, if you want excitement, and if you don't get enough excitement during the day doing flight ops, do night flight ops. That is really interesting. And so I quit. And there again, I'm laying in bed. It's October 1971, 4 o'clock in the morning. I wake up and I think to myself, why don't I become a firefighter? Do I go to a firehouse, sit down with a couple firefighters and say, tell me what you like about this job. Tell me what you don't like about this job. That's what normal people do. I'm not normal. I just made the decision. So I went to Santa Barbara City College. I got a 2-year degree in fire science. And while I'm there, I take a tennis class. And looking across the tennis courts, there's this girl. And she's got long hair. I mean, the hair down to her belt, you know. And I was immediately smitten, you know. And I didn't get her phone number that time. But the next semester, I'm in social psychology, and she sits down directly behind me. And so in that hour, I asked her for her phone number. And the next week, she wasn't there. She dropped out of class. I mean, in AA, we talk about seconds and inches. If I had not asked her in that hour period of time for her phone number, I would have a totally different story today. You know, so I got her phone number and we started dating June of 73, I think it was. And, you know, she was living with a mother who liked pills, benzodiazepines, been on benzodiazepines since 1952, and crazier than a loon. And all she wanted to do was out. And so I announced I was moving to San Diego to get a job, you know, because there was more firefighting jobs in San Diego than here. And so in fact, I asked her to marry me. She said, no, I won't marry you, but I'll move to San Diego with you. And I said, okay, you know, I'll take what I can get. And so we moved down there and, you know, she got a job as a physical therapy aide. And I got a job as a firefighter, crash structural firefighter with United States Navy at Marine Field. It's an air base right on the Tijuana border. I wound up going to North Island. I was 2 years both places. And at the end of 4 years being a firefighter, my wife came up to me and said, I've decided I want to become an occupational therapist. She had her choice between PT or OT, and she decided on OT. And she says, the only state school is San Jose. And I thought, well, I'm not real committed to this fire thing, even though I had spent, you know, 6 years of my life going to school and working in the field, which it would have served me well to stay. But, you know, I was more dedicated to my wife than I was to my career. And so we sold our house. We packed up. We moved to San Jose, went back to school. She became an occupational therapist. I got a bachelor's degree in health sciences and a master's in public health. And during those 4 years in school, we were looking because we didn't want to raise kids in California. And so I looked at Portland, Spokane, Seattle, and Boise. And at the end of 4 years of school, I said, how about Boise? And she goes, well, we moved to San Jose for me, and I'm ready to move wherever you want to go for you. And so we went and checked it out. And of course, she was offered a job the first day she was there because there is no OT schools in that state. And so, you know, I was still working a project at Santa Clara County Health Department. And she moved up there in January of 81. I moved up in May. And of course, she was working right off the bat. It took me a while to find work. And so that sets where we are. Now, Tuesday night, I'm doing a discussion of the first step and the first tradition at a steps, traditions, concept meeting in San Diego. And so I wrote up a thing on the first step. And basically, I think to tell you how I got broken, I'm just going to read this because it's taken me some time to write this. It's easier for me to read it because it puts all my points together than kind of just pulling it out of my mind as we go along. So it's about three paragraphs. So let me turn on my light here. She was the light of my life. We had been married for 7 years and together for 10. She was an occupational therapist at Elks Rehabilitation Hospital in Boise and 8 months pregnant with our first child. We were watching fireworks on July 5th, 1982. She loved fireworks, Christmas, and cats. On that night, she had developed a severe stomach ache. We went to the hospital. The doctor gave her a shot of Demerol, which relaxed the muscles enough to allow the aneurysm to burst in her brainstem. Her eyes went to pinpoints, and I was aware what was happening. The ER staff asked me to leave the room. As I left, I said to myself, this is going to change the rest of my life. The doctor spoke to me after the CAT scan was completed. He said, you better start calling family. She's not going to survive. All of this had happened in less than 1 hour. I was unable to comprehend what was happening to me, my wife, and our baby. Because of the holiday weekend, there wasn't any clergy or social work staff available. I started calling friends from her work. They started to arrive around 2 a.m. I was living in hope and somehow this nightmare would end. I just wanted to go home with my healthy and vibrant wife. My denial started to erode at 3 a.m. At that time, her fingers started to swell and the impending loss became real to me. At 6 a.m., I became a father. We took my son's cesarean section from my wife's dying body. My son was put into the NICU and now I had two places to be in the hospital. My family arrived at 3 p.m. It was difficult to place all of my family members in Boise, being a father and soon to be widowed. I had a beer. It did not touch the emotional pain, shock, or trauma that was visiting me. At 9 a.m. the next morning, the hospital called. My wife was near death. I couldn't go to the hospital. To this day, I regret that decision, but it was made many years ago, and I can only forgive myself for being a human being today. A friend, a nurse, went so that my wife did not die alone. I'm a hospice volunteer today to allow myself to experience death with families. And then what happened from that point on was it was an absolutely horrendous year and a half I was trying to work and have housekeepers, and they would take care of my son during the day, and I would come home and be available for my son at night. My wife was a small stature woman, and so my son was born at 3 pounds. I took him home at 5, and so when you fed him, his stomach was small like the rest of him, and he didn't eat much. And so instead of having, like a 3-hour feeding cycle, I had more like a 2-hour feeding cycle. And so I would be up and down during the night, trying to work during the day. And somewhere in there, I was still drinking, and it went on for a year and a half that way. It was just a mess. My life was a mess, and I really felt like I'd been screwed. Because I had done everything right. I had served my country. I had 3 college degrees. I'd done the right thing. And this is presented to me. And so I just saw no end to this. I just saw this going on forever. And somehow I felt to blame for his cerebral palsy. And so I decided my solution was to kill him and kill myself. it was a Monday night. You know how God works. You know, it was a Monday night, and I happened to have therapy group that night. And I went to group and I told them, I said, my plan tonight is to kill my son and kill myself. And my therapist said, you got to stay after group. And so he said, basically, it's unsafe for your son to be with you. And it is unsafe for you to be with your son. Somebody has to go someplace. Said, is there a family member that could take your son? And I thought, well, I have in-laws in Santa Barbara, California. I don't like them. They don't like me, but they really love their grandson. I'll see what's up. So I went home and I called them and they said, yes. And I had my first spiritual experience. Literally, I was walking on air. Literally, I could feel the tension coming off of my shoulders. You know, I did not want to kill my son and I did not want to kill myself, but I saw that was my only way out. Remember, you know, going to photography school and becoming a firefighter. I don't ask people anything. I just make decisions. Well, this time, you know, thank God I talked about it in group. So my in-laws came up. And they took him. And of course, my housekeeper left. And so I went from this this household that was just in manic energy all the time, dealing with him and dealing with her and dealing with myself and my drinking and all that, to everything was gone. The kid was gone. The housekeeper was gone. The in-laws were gone. I was all by myself in that house. And I remember, after the first week that he was gone, I would wake up like 3 o'clock in the morning to his cry, you know, and I've talked to women. They say, oh yeah, you know, you get that stuck in your head that you're needed, you know? And so I continued to try to find some sort of life. I had no life. I mean, I went from a man with, you know, a successful wife and a successful life to just nothing. You know, I don't have a kid. I don't have a wife, you know, I just nothing. And so I was going to churches and like, Nope. I went to a widower's group. I was the only one there under 75 years old. And they asked me, oh, I was the guest speaker. And I'm going, that doesn't work. Doesn't work. And then I had a friend who was a therapist at Salvation Army. And she said, hey, there's this, you know, I just shared a little bit of my story with her. And she goes, there is one Al-Anon meeting a week in Boise that deals with adult children issues. Why don't you go check it out? And, you know, I still remember going to that meeting. You know, I still remember that Monday night. I mean, and driving there, I remember turning left into the parking lot. I remember going up the stairs. I remember that room. And I sat down and people started going around the perimeter. You know, there's chairs around the perimeter of the room and they started sharing the story. And I'm going, yeah, yeah, I grew up in that household. Yeah, I identified. And I thought, God, this is great. These people understand me. I understand them. This is wonderful. You know, the only problem I had was the God word. You know, because they had the steps on the canvas banners in the room and reading the steps. Of course, they read the steps in Al-Anon also. I couldn't, but, you know, just like, you know, God as we understand him, you know. Well, I could not say God without putting the F word in front of it, you know. And I'd been screwed by God as far as I'm concerned. I did everything right and I got screwed, you know. And so a woman, Janet Cardoza, she said, you know, Peter, can you have an imaginary friend you talk to? And I said, yeah, I can do that, you know. And so I started talking to this imaginary friend. I've always been a self-talker, you know. My wife used to listen to me talk to myself in the bathroom outside the bathroom door. And she once said, you know, Peter, you talk about some of the most boringest things. And so I talked to myself for a while, and then I needed to name my God, and I couldn't call him God yet. So I called him George. And then I had to get a thing to symbolize George in my life. So I got a teddy bear. I stuck him in the corner of my room, and I used to talk to George, my teddy bear. And then I needed a human form of God. And so I adopted, I don't know if you guys remember, back in the 80s, there used to be a Jamaican who sold the Uncola nut for 7-Up. And he was laid back and everything was wonderful and accepting. He was, and so he was my first human form of a God. And then I moved into Universal Power of Good, and I was there for probably about 15 years. And so I'd been in Al-Anon about 2 years, and I was still drinking. You know, I would go in, talk about my feelings, and go across the street, buy a six pack, and go home, you know. But I didn't get drunk too often. I drink, but I wouldn't get drunk. You know, my last drink is not my last drunk. My last drink was 2 Miller Long Necks at a bar named Fats on Front Street in Boise, January 24th, 1987. That was not my last drunk. My last drunk was on a camping trip with my roommate, Andy, at Little Jack's Creek, south of Bruno. We had driven in, hiked in, and, you know, we had dinner, and we looked at each other and said, boy, a bottle of scotch would be good. And we hiked out. We hiked out, got in, and we drove to the package store. I mean, it took us like 3 hours. And the next morning, I got so sick, I threw up inside the tent, outside the tent. And the next morning, Andy looked at me and said, you attacked that bottle, you know. And, you know, we have those moments of clarity in our lives, not just with drinking, but just with all our things about being a father and being married and about being all those things, those character defects that pop up in front of us. And that's one of those times. And so I'd been invited to work at a treatment center, working with families on the weekends, because I'd been in Al-Anon for 2 years. And so I was kind of like an Al-Anon counselor guy. And so what happened was the main counselor went out on pills. And so they came to me and said, you know, our main counselor has left. And before we can open this up, we have to offer you the position. And so I said, sure. You know, there again, you know, do I ask questions? Do I sit down and say, what does this involve? What do I have to do? Did it? Nope. Instantaneous decision. Yep, let's do this. Well, there I am. I am this fledgling alcoholic counselor, working with a bunch of drunks from Monday to Friday, and then drinking on the weekends and going to Al-Anon. Well, the problem is they're going through treatment and so am I. People will say, you know, did you go through treatment? I said, well, I went through treatment 18 times. Thing is, I got paid to do it, you know? So yeah, I worked there for a year and a half, and treatment was a month long. So yeah, I went through treatment 18 times. And what would happen is, you know, people would come into the hospital and go, I think I have a drinking problem. And they go, okay, go see this guy. And that guy was me. And then I would give them all these tests and all this stuff and get a report back. And I would write this report up. And this one guy was the crack in my egg. And that was when he said, I love the Navy. Everybody drank exactly the same way I drank. And it went click, you know? And like that morning after, I had those 2 Miller Long Necks at Fats Bar on Front Street in Boise. I woke up that Sunday morning and I had been associated with a social group, Al-Anon, for 3.5 years. That it was okay not to drink. I had a total social group that was okay not to drink. And I said, you know what? I'm going to quit drinking. And I came into AA as a third tradition drunk, which is I had a desire not to drink today. That's all I had. I had a desire, you know, because the long-term consequences of drinking was not there. You know, I hadn't been to prison. I hadn't had a DUI. This July 29th will be my 50th anniversary of being arrested at a bar in Goleta called the Barbary Cave for drunken auto. That's the only legal involvement that I had ever. And that's 50 years ago, you know? And so I quit drinking because I had a desire not to drink. It was not productive to my life, you know? And so I started going to AA. And most people in AA in Boise knew me as an Al-Anon person. But the first guy that I met named George, I hired him as my sponsor because George had been God to me in Al-Anon. Well, the first time I met with George and I told him my story, he goes, okay, we're working steps, we're doing that. But we didn't have an Alano club in Boise at the time. And so his house was always open. Front door was always open. Him and his wife were both in recovery. And they had two coffee pots. So there was always one that was on. What he said, he's kept one on for 12 hours. At 12 hours, you know, the coffee was getting acidy and he'd throw it away and make a new pot. Everybody got a handshake and a hug except for me. When I walked in, he would cock his head to a corner and he would look at me and go, "Don't you have a son in Santa Barbara?" And I go, "Yep." He goes, "What the hell are you doing here?" And I didn't have an answer for him. Well, eventually I got laid off from my job because I was getting crazy. I went over and saw George. I told him I got laid off and he looks at me and he smiles and he goes, "You're moving to Santa Barbara." I go, "I am." And that was March 15th, 1988. And I left on May 1st that year. And the night before I left, I sat down and I wrote down 32 miracles that happened between March 15th and May 1st to get me back to California. Most of them I have forgotten. But when I tell this story, I tell this one. Is that I had a Toyota truck and a catamaran sailboat and a U-Haul truck to get to California. I needed a driver. And there was a woman from Al-Anon named Zan. And I was going to go over and ask her to drive my U-Haul truck. I went over, I walked in. She was sitting in the kitchen. I walked in the kitchen. She turned to me and she said, "I want to go to Laguna Beach." And I said, "You want to drive a U-Haul truck to Laguna Beach?" And she goes, "Sure." And I had my driver, you know, I mean, and I had 31 other miracles like that, just doors just opening up for me. And so I left Boise, and which is really unusual for us. Usually the town you get sober in, you stay in. We had a guy in Santa Barbara named Tex that he fell off a freight train drunk. He was from New Jersey originally, but he fell off the freight train, got sober in Santa Barbara, and Santa Barbara was his home. That's where he lived, you know, and that's really common with us. Wherever we get sober is home. And so when I'm leaving Boise, I'm leaving my family. You know, for the first time in my life, I had a family. I mean, when I left for the Navy, I was glad to leave my family of origin. You know, this time I was not happy. I was sad. I was crying driving up that hill. You know, I didn't know what laid in front of me. I knew I was going to a town that two people didn't like me. They were afraid that I was going to take their grandson away from them. I mean, it was not good. And I rolled into Hawthorne, Nevada that night, got a hold of the newspaper and opened up to page A2. And there's a column on the left-hand side, excuse me, with all of the fraternal groups, you know, Elks, Moose, all those. And you go all the way down to the bottom and it's AA. So I called the number and they say, "Oh yeah, She says, we're a small recovering community here. And we meet together. Al-Anon AA meets together here. We're down at the school. Just walk on down here. And so I'm walking down and I'm walking across the playground of the school and this window opens and this guy sticks his head out of this window and he yells across the playground, you looking for AA? And I go, yeah. He says, here we are. And I walked in and I was home. That was the lesson I learned that night, was that I can walk into any meeting around the world. And I've been to a lot of meetings around the world and I'm home. I just settle in. We know the jargon. We know, you know, you just look at each other and you go, ah, one day at a time, this too shall pass. Oh yeah, take it easy, turn it over. And then we got our jargon, you know, and we fit. So then I roll into Santa Barbara and I'm transferring my unemployment from Boise to Santa Barbara. And I meet with the first guy. First guy says, you a veteran? I go, yeah, you got to talk to the next guy. Talk to the next guy. And the next guy says, well, you have a place to live? I go, nope. Well, you got to talk to the next guy. So I talked to the next guy. Next guy I talked to was Jack Crane. Jack became my first sponsor, you know. And he found me a place to live. He found me a job. I worked in construction with another drunk for 6 months. And I learned a lot in 6 months being in construction. I loved working in construction. The general contractor I worked with had his master's in counseling. And then I had my MPH and it was just the two of us, you know, and we had a lot of interesting discussions. And then I, Jack, my sponsor, decided to leave his job at unemployment. And he said, you want it? I said, sure, you know, and I became a job developer. And then by being a job developer, I found my next job, which was administrator of a community health clinic in Santa Barbara, where I stayed for 10 years. And during this time, I met my second wife and it didn't work. You know, I mean, there was liabilities on her side, liabilities on my side. I was not ready. I don't know if I'm ready to be married again, you know, just because I'm just kind of damaged and damaged goods. I don't know if I can get along because of my own assumptions about that. But the light of my life today is my son. And he's 38, believe it or not. And probably half of you know him. He runs up and down State Street in his power wheelchair. And he was doing that about, 20 years ago. And woman steps out of Sur La Table, which is a high-end kitchen supply store on State Street, points at him and says, you want a job? And he goes, yeah. He wound up being a greeter for Sur La Table for the Christmas season. And he stayed there for 6 years. And then he really liked music. His mom liked music. His grandpa played clarinet in the school band. I mean, we all like music. And so, you know, I gave him two speakers I had bought in the Philippines and he played a dance at his, at Dos Pueblos High School. And he started his own DJ business, which is still going on to this day. And of course, he got me as a roadie until I turned 60. I told him when I turned 60, I was done being his roadie. But yeah, he went to Santa Barbara City College, got a 2-year certificate in sound design. Currently, he's working as a job developer for United Cerebral Palsy. He worked at the Moxie Museum. And sometimes when he has a wedding or something like that he's doing and he needs a lot of hands, he'll call me up and I'll come down and do it. But I'm 73, he's 38, and I have this relationship with my son, and I've never done this before. My dad died when I was 18, and we were estranged my whole life. You know, I've never been a father of a grown son. And I tell that to my son, and my son says, I've never done this either, Dad. You know, And so he calls me 3-4 times a week, wants my opinion. You know, he's had, you know, heartache also, you know. Currently, he's met a new lady. Julia lives in LA. She's from Ukraine, and she's disabled also. And so they're waiting for their COVID shots to be done, and he wants to go see her. And of course, I'm driving, you know. My son doesn't drive, and that's been a real connection between me and my son when he wants to go someplace, you know. And I think God has really smiled on me going through this struggle. I mean, just yesterday, Zena, District 15, Bakersfield, she calls me up and she goes, "We want you to be the moderator for Seniors in Sobriety at PRASA this year." And I said, "Okay, that's what we do. We say, okay, we are going to do that. And you need to find a host and you need to find a scribe." I go, "I can do that." So I called my sponsor. My sponsor is Ken in San Diego. He's got 47 years and he's the manager of Central Office in Vista. And I said, "Hey, Ken, remember that old slogan that you never say no to an AA request? I need you to be host of my round table of seniors in sobriety at PRASA." And he goes, "Well, I don't know. I got to close my books, you know, my February books, I got to close." And then there's a long pause and he goes, "Okay, sign me up. I'll do it." You know? And then I go to that Step Traditions concept meeting in San Diego. And last week we had a guy named Billy N. He's a former trustee, came and spoke about the deteriorating relationship between the professional community and us, AA. Well, I happen to be the new chair of cooperation with the professional community for the area up here. And so I'm going, "Why don't we do a workshop on what's going on between us and treatment centers and doctors and dentists and all that?" And I'm talking to a former delegate in San Diego, and she's going, "I think that's a great idea." So I call this Billy guy back east. I don't know where he is from back east. And he goes, "Yeah." So we're going to be doing that April 3rd. And hopefully I'll get some flyers out and you guys can do that. And my time's coming to an end. So this is what I want to end with. I want to end with a quote from Saint Augustine. And he says, "Men go forth to wonder at the heights of mountains, the huge waves of the sea, the broad flow of rivers, the vast compass of the oceans, and the course of the stars, and they pass by themselves without wondering." You know, and that's the greatest gift I have received in sobriety, is the ability to understand who I am. You know, three old wise spirits wanted to give a gift to humans, and they said, "We want them to work for it. Where should we hide it?" And the first old guy says, "We're going to hide it on the top of a mountain." And the other two go, "You know, they're industrious enough. They'll find a way to get to the top of the mountain and find the gift." And they're all like, "Yeah, that's probably true." The second old wise guy goes, "Let's put it at the bottom of the ocean. No, they're industrious. They'll figure out a way to get down there." And the third one says, "I know where we'll put it, and they'll never look." And the others go, "Where's that?" And they go, "We're going to put it inside of them." So that's what we have to do today. You know, the longest journey we're ever going to take is within ourselves. Thanks for listening to me tonight. Now I'm done.
Thanks, Peter. Everybody can unmute if you would like to.
Awesome, Peter. Great job, brother.
Good job, Peter.
Woo!
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
Love it.
That
was awesome.
Thank you, Peter.
Great job, Peter.